morning.
Good morning.
I call the February 10th, 2025 meeting of the House Fraud Prevention and State Agency Oversight Committee to order. A quorum is present. Before we begin our meeting, I just want to remind everyone that the committee expects proper decorum at all times. All dialogue goes through the chair. Signs are not allowed in the committee room. There will be no outbursts or clapping. There is no standing or sitting in the walkways or aisles. If accommodation is needed, please communicate with the Sergeant at Arms staff, and there will be consequences for disruption. Thank you to the Sergeant at Arms staff who are present for helping to maintain decorum in the committee room. So, since this is our first meeting with all of our members in attendance, we will begin with introduction of members and staff. Members, please tell us your district and committees that you communities you represent and your professional background. Staff, we look forward to hearing about your role in the House. So I'm gonna call, why don't we start with you, Lee Pinto. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So glad to be with you and be with everybody. So representing Dave Pinto from the southwest part of St. Paul. You asked about professional background. I work as a prosecutor with the Ramsey County Attorney's Office outside the legislature. Specialized in gender violence, domestic assault, and sexual exploitation cases for a number of years, but for quite a while now, I've handled a wide variety of felony-level cases, mostly felony-level cases, and some lower level as well. And then I have a policy expertise in a number of the areas of our state budget as well. And so glad to be with you. I will have a general question, but maybe I'll ask you, Madam Chair, once the introductions are done, if that will end up being okay with you. But thank you, and glad to be with you.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, the C director. This is fine. Okay, Steve Elkins. I represent District 50B, which is the prestigious west half of Bloomington. And by education, I'm an economist. I moved here 40 years ago to set airfares for Republic Airlines. But for the last 25 years, I've worked in information technology as an information architect.
Representative Greenman.
Good morning, and it's nice to join you at this first meeting. Representative Emma Greenman, I represent 63B, which is the whole sort of strip of the south side of South Minneapolis. My background, I started my career as a public defender, but I am a voting rights lawyer who has spent a lot of time thinking about the way our systems and processes and allow public transparency and people to participate. And I am also on elections, workforce, labor, and economic development, and public safety, and on the OLC with Representative Anderson.
Great, thank you. Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm Representative Marion Rarick, formerly O'Neill for everyone that followed me for the last 12 years in the legislature, and sometimes still call me that. The reason my name changes, I married State Senator Jason Rarick, and I've spent over 20 years working in various nonprofits, big, small, international, local, doing everything from the ground up, from photography and videography to accounting to running international offices, the U.S. office. Worked at Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge and Habitat for Humanity as ones here in Minnesota. So I'm very interested in the topic today, and I've been doing my digging, and I'll be doing a whole lot more digging. So I appreciate, Madam Chair, the opportunity to serve with you on this committee.
Thank you. Representative Schultz.
I'm Representative Isaac Schultz. I represent House District 10B, which includes a large swath of central Minnesota, including five counties from Isani, Kennebec, Mille Lacs, Benton, my home of Morrison County in the small town of Uppsala. And I come from a family business of auctioneers and happen to be a state champion in that regard. And glad to be with you all this morning and throughout the entirety of this legislative session. Thank you.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Walter Hudson from District 30A, Northeastern Wright County. My professional background is an eclectic mix of different blue-collar positions in various sectors, commercial, public safety, and logistics. including management, supervision, managed a logistics company before coming here to the legislature, and I've also done some work in media. I'm on education, finance, judiciary, and public safety in addition to this committee, and very much look forward to the work that we're going to do here.
Thank you. Good morning, Vice Chair Patty Anderson.
Thank you. I'm Patty Anderson. I am the Vice Chair of this committee. I represent what I would call Northwestern Washington County. So that's probably the best description for that. I'm a small business owner. I've had a variety of small and mid-sized businesses throughout my career and currently do still. And I'm also, Representative Grumman said, I serve on the Legislative Audit Commission. And that's, you know, I have some background in that too. So thank you.
Thank you. So I'm State Representative Kristen Robbins. I represent District 37A, which is western suburbs of Hennepin County, so the communities of Maple Grove, Medina, Corcoran, Greenfield, Independence, Loretto, and Maple Plain. I love my district. And I'm delighted to be chairing this committee and working with all of you, so really appreciate everyone coming today. And now I would just like to start with staff introductions with RCA, Harry Kennedy.
Harry Kennedy, I'm the committee administrator. Been at the legislature since 2011 in various capacities, and excited to be working with you all for the session.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, members, Ben Johnson with House Research Department. I primarily staff the public safety and judiciary. I've been with the legislature since 2016. Before that, I was a practicing attorney. I did both civil and criminal practice.
Thank you. Aaron.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Aaron Bercy with GOP Caucus Research.
Thank you. And Caitlin.
Hi there. I'm Kate Miller. I'm the CLA for the Frog Committee. I'm from Carlton County, small town, Esco, Minnesota. Just moved here about a month ago, so I'm happy to be here.
Welcome. John Beeler, DFL Research. I have been with the legislature for about 4 years now, and prior to that, I was an attorney in private practice and some public interest work as well. Thank you.
Thank you. And I also have the Democrat CA, Anna Bordeling, here. And we're grateful for your work on the committee as well. I'd also like to introduce our page, Sierra. She's on our team and will be with us all the time. So if anyone needs anything, please reach out to Sierra. Great. Well, I'm going to introduce our esteemed guests in just a minute, but I wanted to just make a couple of comments as we start this new work. It's a new committee of the legislature, and I'm delighted that it is bipartisan. And I just want to point out the need for this committee. So the last story I saw in the press was that we are currently sitting at about $610 million in fraud over the last 6 years in the state of Minnesota. Not only is that an appalling waste of taxpayers' hard-earned money, it is also an indictment of state agencies' failures to serve the people who really need services. The mission of this committee is to ensure that taxpayer money is not going to the greedy, but is going to serve the needy. As I have said many times since I was first named chair, this is not a partisan issue. It is a separation of powers issue. The legislature appropriates money, and we also have a duty to exercise oversight of executive branch agencies tasked with spending it. As the former U.S. attorney and prominent Democrat Andy Lugar noted last December, quote, I think there needs to be a lot more done, and people need to have serious conversations and get to the root of this, stopping it before it happens. I just see it, and no other state has had a feeding our future. We did. No other states have the kinds of problems we've had with government fraud, but other states have problems we don't have. Members, this is why we are here, to have serious conversations and get to the root of the fraud so that we can put systems in place that will stop it before it happens. I'm so thankful that all of you have joined this committee, and I look forward to getting to work. So now, without further ado, I'd like to introduce today's... I'm sorry. Representative Pinto, yes, I said I would defer to you. Please bring forth your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, it's sort of a two-part question. So the first is, it's my understanding that the committee will not be considering bills, but sort of more informational hearings. I may be wrong about that, but if you could just clarify that, and then I'll have a follow-up question.
Yes, so we are certainly open to considering bills, and I would expect most of them would be referred from state gov. Some of the bills that have already been introduced about Inspector General and some of the governor's provisions that are being brought forward So they may be referred to our committee, but I don't believe that's been worked out. I also have a bill that I worked on with the OLA more than 4 years ago that I'm hoping will finally get a hearing in my own committee. So I expect we will be hearing that bill. But most of the work, to your point, will be a lot of oversight and discussion of issues that have been brought to light through whistleblowers who are contacting me dozens every, maybe not a dozen last week, but we've had dozens of contacts, and we want to start digging into some of the concerns that have been raised by the public.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair. And so then the second half of that, I guess, is given that individual committees have jurisdiction over, you know, particular agencies, how do you view the role of this committee as compared to, I'm sort of thinking about, you know, each of the committees has, you know, where the Department of Education, Department of Public Safety, et cetera, as things are coming up. And of course, those chairs and those committees can review actions of the agencies, et cetera. How do you view this committee's work kind of different from the committees which sort of more typically would be handling things?
Right. I think we'll be working cooperatively with the Standing Policy Committee. So clearly they have oversight in their areas, and our committee has a broader role. And this is being a budget year, they might not have time to do the deep dive on some of the fraud issues or the waste issues. So my expectation is that there will be some overlap, but that we'll work cooperatively with the chairs of those committees throughout the process, so that, you know, we're not duplicating effort, but that we are maybe providing a deeper layer of than their committee has time for.
Okay, good. Thank you. And I'll, and maybe, Madam Chair, if I can, I'll just note that my DFL colleagues and I are really pleased to be on the committee, as we said before, and are looking forward to kind of to learning more and exploring more. Certainly, we want to make sure that the public funds are being used for public goods, so we'll be eager to continue the conversation. Thank you.
Great. We look forward to everyone participating. There's a lot to do. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, ma'am. Representative Rarick.
Thank you. Just really quickly to that point, I would turn everyone's attention to the legislative audit report that's in your folder on page 7. This is a really good illustration as to why this committee is so incredibly needed. And one of the things here is it shows the number of nonprofit grantee organizations, and just the Department of Human Services alone in a 5-year period had 592 individual, unique, nonprofit organizations that received grants. A little bit further down, the Department of Health was 462. Further down from there, the Minnesota Board, or excuse me, State Arts Board was 597. It's impossible for a committee to possibly do due diligence on that many nonprofits, grants, and so on and so on. So I'm really looking forward to this, and having an opportunity, like I said, I worked 20 years in various nonprofits, all the way from very small to very big, and I'm very interested to see how this process happens. So, Madam Chair, I am very grateful to be a part of this committee. I just wanted to point that out. Again, page 7 of the audit report that's in your packet.
Thank you, Representative Rarick. So the first and only agenda item today is the presentation from the legislative auditor entitled Oversight of State-Funded Grants to Nonprofit Organizations. We are very fortunate to have State Auditor Judy Randall and Deputy Legislative Auditor and Director of Program Evaluation Jody Munson Rodriguez with us today for their presentation. So ladies, please introduce yourself for the record and then proceed for your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Judy Randall, Legislative Auditor. I'm pleased to be here today. And I'll just say broadly, happy to support the committee however we can with the work that we have done. As you all have said, we're going to be discussing this report that we released in 2023 related to oversight of state-funded grants to nonprofit organizations. I'll note it's not the first kind of broad look at grant funding that we have done. We did one back in 2007, which resulted in the Office of Grants Management in the Department of Administration being established. And since that time, we have done a number, I think we have lost track within the office, of kind of one-off looks at how a given program maybe is handling their grants. And so I was really happy to have this report that we can present to you, because it looks at a couple of specific programs, but then it really takes a step back and looks globally at how are we handling grants as a state, and where there are problems, why, right? And hearing those voices from the agencies who are managing the grants as well. I also just want to note that in your packet should be this kind of booklet that is a new format of updates that we have done. So in the past, we have released kind of one-page updates that may be also in your packet related to the state-funded grants report. This year, we did something different, where we just listed all the recommendations we made in a given report, and then in a back-and-forth working with the agency, tried to establish, well, we tried to confirm if those recommendations had been implemented, not implemented, or something in between. And so we are also happy to talk about that. I think it will really be a good tool for legislative oversight, thinking about the chair's comments in terms of the separation of government and the legislature's role in providing that oversight. Our intention is that this report is more useful for all of you, so you can quickly look back, see what has and hasn't happened in response to our reports, and then have a discussion about why. There are reasons why agencies haven't implemented recommendations. And a lot of those reasons make sense. And so I want to be clear that where it says not implemented isn't like a shame and a pointing finger. It's, okay, what's going on? Maybe this is an area for the legislature to have additional questions and conversations. Just to that point, and then I promise we will get to the full report. If you notice that this booklet is organized by entity, and at the end is the legislature. And it's all the recommendations we have made for the legislature. And you will note that a lot of them have not been implemented. And that makes sense, right? You have a lot of different things to consider, not just our recommendation. You know, maybe it wasn't something you agreed with. Maybe it took too much time. Maybe whatever. The point is that there are good reasons why some of our recommendations aren't implemented, and that is the place where I think there can be additional conversation and additional legislative oversight. So I just wanted to point that out real quickly. But now we will turn to the real matter at hand, and if I could, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to Deputy Legislative Auditor Munson Rodriguez. Thanks.
Yes. Thank you so much, Legislative Auditor Randall. Welcome, Legislative Deputy Auditor Rodriguez. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jody Munson Rodriguez, and I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor for OLA's Program Evaluation Division. Thank you, Representative Rarick, for bringing everyone's attention to this booklet you have in your packet. I will be referring to a few pages in there if you're interested in more detailed information. So, just giving you a visual. In this evaluation, we really researched two main questions. So first, how comprehensive were Minnesota's grants management policies, and how well did state agencies follow them? I want to note that some of the findings that we have in this report are based on the policies at the time that we did this report, and I will be going over some recommendations and some of the changes that have occurred since then. The second big question we looked at was how well did state agencies follow the policies that were in place. So briefly, some of the key findings based on this work, we found that Minnesota's grants management policies did establish many practices that are important for effective management, but they generally lack sufficient detail for state agencies on how to best implement them. In addition, OLA found pervasive noncompliance with these policies in recent years. One of the reasons we identified for this potential noncompliance is statutes provided little authority to enforce state agencies' compliance with them. So now I'm just going to step back a little bit, provide some very basic information, some context around these findings, and then I'll talk a little bit about some of our recommendations and their implementation statuses. So first, just a real brief primer, how do grants work in Minnesota? The legislature appropriates money to state agencies for state-funded grants. The agency then is responsible for distributing and overseeing the grant. So in one example, the legislature awards funding to the Department of Public Safety for the Youth Intervention Program. The department awards grants for this program to many different nonprofit organizations, including, for example, Lutheran Social Services, which then provides early intervention programs for youth. Now, another example would be that the legislature provides funding to the Department of Education for early learning scholarship programs. They, in turn, provide grants to several pass-through organizations, such as Think Small.
And then those pass-through organizations provide the scholarships to eligible families, but they're paid to childcare and early learning institutions. So those would be the subgrantees. State agencies spent an annual average of about $514 million on state-funded grants per year to nonprofit organizations in fiscal years 2018 through 2022, with a high in 2021 of $616 million. State agencies awarded grants to about 2,400 nonprofit organizations in that five-year period. The median amount of award over the five-year period was about $68,000, and 75% of organizations received less than $440,000. Now, the Department of Administration's Office of Grants Management was responsible for creating statewide grants management policies and is now responsible for updating them and acting as a resource on them. These policies span the life cycle of the grant, so they cover the pre-award, the active grant, and the closeout phases. They establish broad requirements that state agencies must meet, but they also provide flexibility on how to implement them. So, for example, OGM requires state agencies to collect progress reports at least annually from state agencies, but they don't establish any minimum standards for the format or the content of those reports. State agencies are responsible for doing that. If you're interested, the policies that were in place at the time of our review are summarized on in Appendix A of our report. So as I noted at the beginning, one of our research questions involved determining the comprehensiveness of OGM policies. One way we did this was by reviewing OGM policies against recommended practices in grants management. We reviewed reports by national organizations and agencies and grouped the practices that we found into 24 recommended practices. We found that OGM's policies partially reflected 17 of those 24 practices. We have more information about those practices in Appendix D of our report. So while OGM policies partially reflected many of these practices, we found that they often lacked important detail. So I'm going to provide a few examples of that here. So as an example, OGM policy required state agencies to complete a pre-award financial review, but the policies did not require the agencies to increase monitoring for grantees that they found to be higher risk. As I noted previously, the policy required state agencies to collect progress reports, but it did not specify any specific information or standards for those reports. Policy required agencies to complete monitoring visits for grants over a certain threshold, but those visits could be conducted by telephone. They do not need to be on site. And as a final example, policy required state agencies to consider certain information about past grant performance before awarding subsequent awards to different grantees, but the policy did not establish a time frame in which to complete the closeout review. And I'll note that all of the items on the right side of this chart are recommended practices. So based on this review, we did recommend that OGM strengthen its policies and provide more specific guidance to agencies. We have more information about that on pages 35 and 36 of the report. I do want to note that since our report was released, the Department of Administration has taken some action on this recommendation. So, for example, based on a law that the legislature passed in 2023, OGM made numerous changes to its pre-award financial review policy, including noting that agencies must develop risk mitigation plans or not award a grant to entities for which they have identified risks. OGM also established a timeline by which agencies must complete closeout reviews. We note that this is partially implemented because they did not take other recommended actions, such as establishing standards for progress reports or requiring on-site monitoring. So as Ms. Randall noted, in this report, we kind of went into depth reviewing a couple of different state agencies, but for this presentation today, I want to talk just a little bit more on the enterprise-wide issues that we found. So at the time we released this report, we had also done 8 financial or internal audit control reports and 2 program evaluations within recent years in which we looked at grants management compliance. And in looking across all of those reports, we found repeat issues both within single agencies and across state agencies. And some of those repeat issues that we found are listed on this slide here. Given the amount of noncompliance that we found, we sought to understand some of the reasons behind it. So we looked at factors related both to state agency capacity to comply with the requirements, as well as accountability measures surrounding those requirements. So first, I'll talk a little bit about state agency capacity. One of the first things we found was that the legislature had funded grants management activities inconsistently across both state agencies and grant programs themselves, which we believed could have affected agencies' compliance with OGM policies. Another factor we identified was training. So while OGM had provided some ad hoc training on these policies, it didn't have in-demand training or kind of regularly scheduled training. Also, no agency officials are required to take any training to manage grants. And a third factor was agency management tools. As you can guess, there are many, many documents that are required in the management of grants. So some agencies use electronic grants management systems. Others use a wide variety of systems in order to do this. I'll note that as part of our review, we surveyed members of the Grant Government Council. That includes 40 grant managers across grant-making agencies in Minnesota. And only 40% of those managers said that they used electronic grants management systems. That meant that 60% were using other kind of ad hoc methods. So just as an example, during our review, MDE used a combination of email, online systems, electronic documents, and actual physical documents to manage their grants. Now, in addition to state agency capacity, we looked at just accountability measures. Since without mechanisms to hold agencies accountable, they may have fewer incentives to comply. So in terms of enforcement, statutes provided little authority for state agency enforce state agency compliance with these policies. There are several entities, including OLA, that have the authority to review agency compliance, but reviewing and reporting is really the extent of these entities' authority. That leaves the legislature as essentially the only body with the authority to act when agencies don't comply, but it's difficult for the legislature to obtain comprehensive information and data both on grants and on state agency grants management activities. Minnesota's only real source for information on grants is the state agency accounting system, but that has very limited information available and no performance information available in it. So this makes it difficult for the legislature and really the public, state agencies, anyone, to review grant performance. So we made a number of recommendations to the legislature. One of them had to do with directing OGM to develop a grants management training program and then requiring all state agency grants management staff to complete that program. The legislature has chosen not to implement this recommendation at this point, although I will note that the Department of Administration has increased the amount of training materials that it has on demand on its website since we released this report. A couple of other recommendations we had was to develop standards for consistently, or to direct OGM to develop standards for consistently funding grants. I'll note that the legislature actually passed a law in 2023 themselves that directed agencies to be able to use a percentage of grant funds to administer those programs. We also recommended that the legislature direct admin to develop recommendations for improving access to data on grants. And also in 2023, the legislature directed admin to assess the viability of implementing a single grants management system. And then last, we recommended that the legislature increase external oversight of grants management in executive branch agencies. We have some suggested options on pages 49 and 50 of our report. We found that the legislature has made some changes that could provide greater oversight. So, for example, it provided the Department of Administration with the authority to suspend or debar grantees under certain circumstances. However, I'll note that several of the duties that the legislature provided to the Department of Administration are discretionary, not required, and that the legislature has not, for example, required any entity to more regularly audit grants. So that concludes my presentation on this report. I'm happy to take any questions.
Great. Thank you both very much. I have many questions, but I think I would like to start the questioning by focusing on some of the compliance issues that you referenced. If we want to just go back to the slide where you talked about things that affect agency capacity, what I found interesting is I think there's more we could do there as a legislature, absolutely. But when you dig into your report, you did a survey of staff at agencies who are responsible for grants management, and 80% of the respondents said that they felt that the OGM policies were reasonable or very reasonable. And they also didn't seem to think, 70% strongly agreed or agreed that state agencies had adequate resources. And further, they felt like the training was good, but they could do more. But what was stunning to me was that the training currently provided is for conflict of interest and monitoring, diversity, equity, inclusion, and grants administration, but there were no training modules on how to detect fraud or compliance or closeouts. So one member said financial reconciliation training is needed, and it's not being provided at all that apparently anyone's found. So I would love your feedback on, like, definitely the legislature has a role to play. Like, should, it's stunning to me to think we would need to micromanage at this level from the state law, but do we need to put in law, have training on fraud detection and financial reconciliation? Does the law that we would put forward need to be that specific?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know that I can comment on the specificity, but I do believe strongly that it would be important to require training. One of the things that we have noted across audits and evaluations in recent years is that when we talk with grants managers, oftentimes they have a lot of program knowledge, but they haven't necessarily been provided with as much training as would be ideal on the policies and how to ensure that they're following those policies. And so by requiring them to take a very kind of base set of training modules to ensure that they really understand what is required of them, I think that we will help them comply in a way that they want to, but perhaps don't have the information to do so. It really is, it is surprising the times when we go in and people know their stuff, they know what they're doing, but there's this kind of little piece of the policy that they just weren't aware of, and they aren't not complying on purpose. Literally did not know. And so I do think that requiring a set kind of baseline so that everybody is starting with a certain set of information would be really helpful.
Thank you. Auditor Randall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll just add, I don't know that you have to be that specific in law as you were suggesting. I think if, to Ms. Rodriguez's point, if you require training on the grants management policies writ large, then that will help educate the staff who are responsible for complying with the policies. And things like financial reconciliation and monitoring, those are embedded in the policies. So it would capture what your point is as well.
Thank you. And I appreciate that. I just have to say it's sort of shocking it's not already happening. So, and it's been in the policies. So perhaps we need to be more specific. My next question, and then I'll turn to members, is it seems like there's quite a continuing struggle to have agencies flag conflict of interest and report that and have that in the files. Can you talk about what you found on that and whether the recommendations that were put forward are starting to be followed, if you've seen any progress there? So I would just love your update on the conflict of interest forms.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will say that we have continued across audits and evaluations to find issues with documentation of conflict of interest with grant reviewers. You know, in terms of whether it has improved, I can note that within our recommendation updates, we have heard from a number of agencies that they have established new processes to ensure that this is happening. You know, for example, places like the Office of Justice Programs at DPS, they have an electronic system where it's part of a checklist. And so it's really automized to make sure that they are doing every piece of it. And we found that there are other agencies that are starting to automate it in that way as well. So I think that that will be helpful. But we have continued to find places where it's just not occurring.
And Madam Chair, if I may, I'll just add a couple of, I think some of the context might be helpful to understand how it occurs, or how the oversight, the lack of it occurs. The folks who are reviewing grants are lots of different people. Sometimes they're agency staff, sometimes they're outside reviewers, right? So you have different folks coming to review. And then there's a timing issue of having people disclose their conflict of interest with maybe a program, but then also you need to know whose application are you reviewing. So then you need to have a list of the applicants and then have all the grant reviewers review it and then disclose any conflicts. It's certainly a feasible thing to do. I know I just said that and you're all thinking, okay, what's the problem? But getting the folks together, getting them the information, it just requires a level of coordination that sometimes seems to be lacking. The other thing I will say is that when we do file reviews, right, we're auditors, and so we are looking for documentation of it. And there are times when the conflict of interest disclosures might happen verbally at a meeting of the reviewers. I know that this has happened in the past on some, for example, some committees looking at legacy proposals. They get together, they say, okay, here are the proposals. Does anybody have a conflict? Let's discuss that now and discuss if somebody has to recuse themselves. So sometimes these things happen verbally, but that needs to be documented for us to know, for the public to know, for you all to know. So again, I think what Ms. Rodriguez said earlier is correct in the at least the vast majority of cases where people aren't trying to not be compliant with the policy. It's just they're not necessarily crossing their T's and dotting their I's. And that's why training is important. That's why you having hearings like this, showing you care about this, and, you know, the state thinks it's important. Those things all add up to helping to improve compliance.
Great. Thank you very much. Ms. Rodriguez.
Madam Chair, thank you. If I may just add one other thing. Another thing that I just want to provide for context is that grant managers look very different across state agencies. So in some cases, that is their only job. They do grants all day, every day, and so they know these policies in and out. But there are other individuals that get kind of grant management pieces piled onto maybe they do standards, maybe they do policies, maybe they do these other things, and so it just becomes another piece of an already full plate. And so I think that that's the place where I think training is really important, especially if it's, you know, a state agency where, oh, we just got this grant, we need somebody to manage it, you're going to do it. If there's that requirement in place, they'll have to take that step to say, okay, we need to get them into this training before they take on that additional role. So I just want to kind of give that in terms of, you know, it looks differently depending on what grant you're looking at and what agency you're looking at.
Great. Thank you very much. All right. Lead Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I kind of want to make sure my head is on straight here. So the report that we're reviewing was the one originally issued in February of 2023. And so when the chair was quoting surveys of employees and all, those would have been conducted, I guess, at least like 3 years ago. Maybe I can just clarify that. Or maybe the chair can clarify that she was reviewing, because I didn't find it in the report, but I submit somewhere in the bound document. Yeah,
page 42.
Page 42.
And 43 in that general section on compliance.
General section on compliance. Thank you, Chair. So in the February 2023 report, so those would have been surveys from employees from several years ago now. And I can see the testifier nodding. And so I'm just wondering to what extent, Madam Chair, because we're talking a lot about state agencies, are we going to be hearing from, like, is Office of Grant Management presenting today? Will we be hearing from them? Because my understanding is that, for example, they're going to have a standard training available to all state employees, like, later this month. I could be wrong about that. I obviously don't work there, but I was trying to just do some digging in advance. But will OGM or their agency be presenting today on some of these findings so we can kind of hear directly?
Thank you, Representative Pinto. I do plan to have OGM in for a similar presentation, but they are not here today.
Okay. And thank you, Madam Chair. And so, I think that'll be useful, because I guess maybe what I'll ask the auditor team then is to what extent, like, if agencies are doing things, is the concern about the legislature requiring the doing of the thing? Like, is it, to what extent is your findings of implementation based on kind of what they're doing versus what we're requiring them to do? That's the kind of distinction that I'm trying to understand.
Thank you. Ms. Rodriguez?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto. I guess our understanding is that not all people who are being required to manage grants have all of the necessary knowledge to do so. We see this, I would say, in just about every evaluation or audit that we find. There's at least some pieces that perhaps they're not aware of that they haven't been trained on. And so we want to make sure that everybody has the knowledge to do their part to comply with regulations. Again, I think that most people want to, and by requiring them to go through a basic set of training, they will have those tools and be able to ensure that they are doing that.
Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Pinto. And I would just add on the specific question. So you're correct, the recommendation had been legislature require OGM to do the training, to provide the training, and then legislature require all folks who manage grants to take the training. And so what Ms. Rodriguez mentioned in her presentation was that while the legislature didn't put those requirements in law, OGM did go ahead, as far as we can tell, and establish more training. We haven't gone through and reviewed it, so, you know, I can't totally confirm, but our understanding is that OGM has developed the training and has made it on demand so that it's more available to folks. The legislature, there's still no requirement for folks to take the training. So it's kind of partially done. So OGM seems like they stepped up and responded to that recommendation without the direction from the legislature. But because grants managers and agencies are not required to take the training, not all of them do.
Okay.
And thank you. Representative Pinto.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And then related to that, and I recall having heard the presentation of this report a couple years ago now, and remember a lot of the focus being that agencies were providing a lot more review of competitive grants than of the direct appropriations, which I think makes sense in terms of resources. You know, if the legislature decides to give money to an individual organization, one can see logically that the agencies would say, we've got limited resources, so they've told us to do this. And I guess is that, maybe first if you can just, either of you just expand on that a little bit, just help me understand that. Because when I flip through the report, I see that again as I did a couple years ago, that seemed to be kind of a common theme, if you wouldn't mind. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto. I would say yes, that is a theme, and it has been a theme probably since OLA started doing reports on grants management. We have consistently found, I know since 2007, that agencies, when deciding how to allocate scarce resources, tend to not provide the same level of oversight over grantees who have been named in law. I will note that the OGM policies still apply to those grants, and that agencies are still required by law to implement that type of oversight that's outlined in policies to all grants, including those that are legislatively named. So that you kind of have two sets of laws, if you will, at a little bit, not at cross purposes, but maybe sending a little bit of mixed messages, because the legislature has said, you know, you have to give $100 to Judy Randall, Inc., right? And so on the one hand, the grant manager is like, well, okay, I got to do it, right? And then on the other hand, the law says you have to implement OGM policies on all grants, including the one where the legislature said you got to give Judy Randall, Inc. $100. So both of those things, all of those things are true, and yet we see less oversight over the ones that are legislatively named.
Okay. Thank you.
And then,
Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you. I know we'll get to others. And so, Madam Chair, and maybe this is maybe to you, Madam Chair. I know we've had, we've made so many changes in the last couple of years and so many improvements, since the report came out. And I'm thinking about the extensive grant requirements and the pre-award risk assessment and the mandatory monitoring and progress reports. And even I was noticing the comment from a agency leader saying, you know, boy, it's really hard when we don't have the resources to actually look into this, and so then given resources. And so I just maybe ask you, Madam Chair, if at some point we'll hear perhaps from our nonpartisan staff of just sort of walking through the many, many changes and improvements that have happened since this report came out. We certainly urge the committee to, and you, Madam Chair, to consider kind of walking us through that, because I think that'll be really helpful.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Yeah, I think that will probably be coming as part of our discussion with the OGM, okay, just to see how they're implementing the laws that were passed in 2023. So I
Thank
anticipate
you.
That'll be part Thank of you. That discussion. Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good timing, because I was going to actually talk about some of the things that Representative Pinto just brought up, so I appreciate that. So in my 13 years here, Auditor Randall, I've never had a review. So when legislature decides this is who we're going to give money to, as you just spoke to, I've never had in committee, like, their 990s over a course of several years, their audited financial reports, their annual reports, their IRS determination letter to know that they actually are duly organized with the IRS, or even here that they're duly organized here with the AG and the Secretary of State. I've never had any of those documents, and I look at the list that you provided, which I reference on page 7, and the vast number, I think you said 2,500 nonprofits that are receiving grants. Not all of those are legislatively approved, but a good number of them are. So if the legislature is appropriating these, and I have personally brought up some of those things, but it certainly isn't provided by the people that come in, and when I've asked those questions, you know, I remember one time we were reviewing something for $10 million, and I said, well, can I at least see your 990? They didn't have anything with. They didn't have their audited financials with. They had nothing with, right? So as a lawmaker that used to create those documents and work with auditing firms that did that, it was surprising to me that none of those documents were provided. So let me just ask you, since you've got us here in a captive audience, is that something that you would recommend to the legislature, that maybe we should take a look at their 990s, their audited financials, their annual reports, their IRS determination letter to make sure that they're compliant with the AG's office and the Secretary of State's office before we even consider whether or not we're going to just hand them $10 million?
Thank you, Representative Rarick. Auditor Randall.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Rarick. So it's a big question. What I would say is there are a lot of things the legislature has to consider, right, when allocating money, when appropriating money. Our recommendation in 2007 was for the legislature to not name grantees in law. period. and leave that to the agencies that both have the program knowledge of, you know, and can assess who could provide the services that you want the best, and also who have taken the grant management training, ideally, and know how to review financial statements and, you know, and all of that. So, you know, while you, Representative Rarick, have a lot of experience looking at those, I'm not sure that everybody does. And so they might not have, they might not know what they're looking at, right? And they might not know how to make the right decisions. So honestly, OLA is on record more than 15 years of saying, just don't name them and let the agencies go through that process and select the entity that is best qualified.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I appreciate that because that's how I feel too. Like I feel like a very unique person here at the legislature. I'm not the only one that's ever worked in nonprofits. I'm not the only one that does finance, but I'm one of the few that will pull it up on my phone as we're going through a committee hearing and say, hey, wait a minute, something looks off here. So, and I can do that quickly and look at that, but it would be a better service, I think, to the state of Minnesota. Like, take your recommendation. Maybe we should stop doing that. That'd be one recommendation. So something else, as I was looking through your report, I found quite curious, and it's right on page 2, so I barely got into the report, but it says that you reviewed the data from SWIFT, and then you had to actually compare it to, you had to cross-check all of that data against the IRS nonprofit list. So you probably, yeah, so I go on that website a lot because that's how I do what I do. But I was shocked that within SWIFT, it doesn't even acknowledge that this is a nonprofit, and maybe you should take a look at that. So can you just, I was shocked when I read that, and that's on page 2 of your report. Can you just talk a little bit about that and maybe recommendations regarding that? Because that seems kind of like square one to me.
Ms. Rodriguez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question. Representative Rarick, I can tell you at the OLA, we can talk data all day. So I really appreciate the question. So SWIFT is, it's an accounting system. It's not set up, it's not designed to provide us with specific information about grants. It's not a grants management system. We use it to provide information on grants because it's really our only data. But it's not set up for really being able to look at programmatic pieces of grants. And so, you know, frankly, it's difficult to even tell sometimes if something reliably is a grant in the system. It's difficult to look at what has been awarded versus what has been expended. It's difficult to tell what type of organization has been awarded the funding. So it's just, it's really not set up to provide the legislature and others with an overview of what's happening in grants management. That's really the reason that we provided that recommendation, that the legislature consider other forms of data for grants so that you have better information. I'll note that in addition to SWIFT, there is a website you might be familiar with called Transparency Minnesota, but a lot of that is based on SWIFT data as well, and so it does have some information for the public on grants to different organizations. But we had to do quite a bit of work just to figure out, you know, pulling down different databases and matching things and hand coding to figure out which ones were nonprofit organizations. Did that answer your question?
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Oh, yes, absolutely. I read that and I thought, how is that even possible when we're spending, I think your report said $2.6 billion to nonprofits over the 5-year period that you looked at them, $2.6 billion to 2,500 nonprofits, unique nonprofits, and we don't even have a system to get to square one to say, and I realize SWIFT isn't that system, but we don't have that system, which is why you had to revert to SWIFT to say, huh, which one of these are even nonprofits? I wonder if this money has been spent or not spent, or, you know, like, we don't even have square one here in Minnesota. We don't even have a grant management tool or a system that we use collectively in the state of Minnesota. And, you know, when I first started looking at all of this, and you talked about the Office of Grant Management, I thought, oh, wow, we've got a whole Office of Grant Management. They must do a fantastic job, and, you know, they must manage all of this data as you were speaking to that. Come to find out there's three people in Office of Grant Management, three people, and that's not their job at all. That all of that compliance and oversight and all of that, all the accountability is at the agency. And as you testified, some agencies have systems and some don't, and some use a good grant management tool and some don't. And so there's just this lack of consistency across all of state government. It's just astonishing to me that we haven't even gotten to square one, which is, I don't know, have one tool where you can actually evaluate everything and figure out, is this a nonprofit? Is it not? Is it, you know, all of those things. So I was reading through your report, and it was just amazing to me. So let me, I'm going to ask one last question, then I'll turn it back to you because I need to ask people to ask.
Ms. Rarick, last question.
Last question. I'm still just sitting here in shock, quite honestly, with the testimony, but the last thing I was going to ask is the most simple thing to find out how a nonprofit is functioning as a site visit. And you had mentioned that in your report and in your testimony both, that, well, sometimes there's site visits and sometimes there's not, and sometimes it's just a telephone call or just a Zoom meeting or something where they're not actually on site. And as we've seen in multiple now reports, both news reports and some of your reports, that, well, I think of Jay Coles was just at a site where he has video of a completely empty daycare center that's, I think it received $7.8 million. There's nothing in it besides empty shelves and some empty boxes. So how long have you been recommending to the legislature that would be an inclusion in the kind of the mandated things that we do is actually go on site and look and make sure that these are both legitimate and they're, if they are legitimate, that they're performing the task that they've been asked to do through the grant.
Ms. Munson-Rodriguez, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As Ms. Randall noted, the last time that we looked across grants management in the state of Minnesota was in 2007. And at that point, we didn't even have OGM. So that was the point at which we recommended that there be an office to establish standards across state agencies. So this was kind of really our next follow-up, and that was when we looked again. We found in trying to find best practices or recommended practices for grants management, we found it was quite difficult. There's not a lot of peer-reviewed journals out there talking about how specifically state agencies should be doing monitoring. So we looked at other federal agencies, we looked at other states, we looked at what different types of nonprofit organizations were recommending. And that site visit was one piece that we pulled out that we thought would be a good addition to what has already been established. I do want to note that Minnesota is ahead of the curve. You know, we found that when we did this, we were one of, I believe, a dozen states that even had statewide grants management policies in place. But, you know, we always want to strive to be better. So that was a piece that we just recommended 2 years ago.
Thank you, Ms. Rodriguez. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you both. I actually saw this audit originally, and I think we did a joint hearing in education, finance, and early childhood a couple years ago. And in some ways, it's the challenge of doing this a couple years after the original reporting. I think there is actually to the a few things that Representative Rarick brought up. I think that there's a report due very soon about a statewide grant management system. One of the things in 2023 that as a legislature we did was ask, follow up on that recommendation, actually ask what it would take and the resources. And so I think that it would be great to hear from them. It's unfortunate that they're not here today to sort of give us more details on that. The other thing I think that in response to the point you made, Representative Rarick, is they went from four people to through 12 in response to this audit. The Office of Grants Management did, because I think that there was a recognition by both in the auditor, by the legislators, that that wasn't enough. And so I think the piece of the a lot of the work that was done, I think, in state government, which I was not on, was doing that. And so we actually have the benefit of being able to hear about some of those updates. Again, the agency isn't here today to give us that, but I hope they will. The other thing I'm really interested actually in working with you on is I do think we need to think about, like, when I saw this audit, I was like, oh, the main takeaways are the legislature isn't appropriating enough or inconsistently the when we do grants, the resources to oversee and sort of administer those grants. And when we name direct grants, it makes it harder for the agencies to do that oversight because we've already determined that we want the money to go there. And so I do think that thinking about our practices, one of the things we have in state law in the construction space is the responsible contracting law, which says that we can't actually, we shouldn't, the state shouldn't give resources to folks who have violated, in addition to labor laws, tax laws, and other things. And I think we should think about what that would look like to expand that, right? Because if you have not followed any of our laws, we should think twice about whether in the future folks should get grants. So I think that I'm interested in talking to you about that. I've been thinking a lot about that. I actually had a few questions about the conflict of interest piece because, you know, I think that we can look right now and see what's happening at the federal level, which is an example of a modeling how not to do it, right? We have an unelected billionaire who is in our finance systems in the Treasury that is rife with conflict of interest. Starlink, Tesla, Twitter, SpaceX, whatever you want to call it, X. And when I think about Minnesota, I haven't, I would sort of ask you this question. When I think about Minnesota and conflict of interest, I don't think we're talking about folks in government who have big conflict of interest. What you're talking about is the paperwork about a conflict of interest disclosure. So that's my, I will just ask that question along with this question, which is, I think that what the Department of Admin has said is, they actually believe that they're following this, that there's a requirement that every government worker conduct, follow the code, and that there's a set of templates, I went on the online, for agencies to do the conflict of interest paperwork. And so my question on the auditing front, and this might be a question for the Department of Administration too, is the issue that you're finding actual conflicts, or is the issue with the paperwork not being standardized?
Ms. Brandler, Ms. Rodriguez.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Greenman. Typically, what we're looking for is the paperwork. So our first step is usually to, when we're doing a file review, we try to determine whether they have appropriately collected conflict of interest forms. That is oftentimes what our findings are about, is if those have not been collected. If we have those collected, we also look to see whether there are any conflicts that have been disclosed, and if so, if they have been documented as appropriately handled. So that would be the other piece.
Thank you, Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Greenman. And I agree with everything Mr. Rodriguez said, and then I wanted to add two things. One, the conflict of interest form, we weren't looking for it to be consistent, so I don't think there's a role there for OGM to make those forms consistent. It's whether it's been completed. And then, of course, if it hasn't been completed or if the identified concerns don't show appropriate mitigation, then there's the opportunity for a conflict. And while OLA has not done a lot of work to track down, you know, a specific reviewer's personal relationships to see if there is a conflict, we have had a few reports in the past that have identified conflicts of interest where somebody was, you know, improperly benefiting as a result of their government position.
Thank you. Representative Greenman.
Thank you. And to that question, was were those places where it sounds like it was found and reported, which is good, places where there was not paperwork, or are they places where there might have been paperwork and you found the conflicts anyways? Just out of curiosity.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Greenman. I'm thinking of one in particular, and it's a complicated, how about if I talk to you offline on it? It's just complicated. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Randall. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when we're looking at both what's in law, maybe even recent changes, and then kind of looking back at the work that you've done over time, how often are we seeing state agencies use progress reports effectively so that dollars that have been allocated are at least ensuring that they're being used?
Ms. Rodriguez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. I think that that's a great question. I think that progress reports can be a wonderful tool to ensure that state agencies can see whether the grantees are moving forward, if they're going to be able to hit the goals for their grant. Unfortunately, one of our biggest findings, I would say, in most of the reports that we've done is that there are issues with collecting progress reports on time. We find a lot of issues with getting the progress reports at all. And we also find issues with violations of state policy where the state agencies are continuing to pay out to grantees even when they have a progress report that is late. And so that's just kind of in terms of, obviously, if they're not getting the progress reports, they're not using them to effectively manage the grant. I think we have also had concerns about looking at the way in which they are used. So again, we're all about documentation. We oftentimes do not find documentation that they have been reviewed or how they have been used. We've been told that oftentimes it's more informal. They read through it. They discuss things with the agency. But you know, I think that that's something that we've pointed out in several of our reports, that we think that these could be used more effectively to manage the grants.
Thank you. Representative Schultz.
Thank you. I think that you answered kind of my second question there, just kind of highlighting this fact that a lot of this information, number one, isn't being given to the state agency that's granting it. Number two, the state agency is potentially not even reviewing it while still continuing payment. Through either your recommendations or looking at what is currently in state law, what should be pursued to close that specific issue?
Auditor Randall, Ms. Rodriguez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question. I guess I will say I'm not sure that it is an issue that the legislature needs to take up. There is already a requirement in grants management policy that a state agency not pay a grantee when they have a past due progress report or if they have not turned in a progress report. That's already on the books. We just need to make sure that that's being followed. And so the one thing I would note is, as I was talking through in my presentation, I think there's space for the Office of Grants Management to provide a little bit more support to state agencies to ensure that they have specific standards for their progress reports, to ensure that they're useful, to ensure that they're using them in a way that it's not just kind of checking a box. We filled out this report and here it is. We hope that they will be using them to actually move forward and help them achieve the goals of their grant. But I think that that's really something that OGM would be most qualified to do.
Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Schultz, I think it's a great question. I agree the requirement already exists, but I do think it gets back to the recommendation about training for the grants management staff, for them to understand what they're supposed to do when they get those progress reports. I mean, my guess is that the nonprofits who are submitting the progress reports put a lot of work into them, or at least some of them do, right? So we're asking the recipient to do this work. And so I do think it's incumbent on us as a state to review those and to know what we're looking for. And I don't think that that is always clear. I do know of things that had been reported, you know, where it's like the exact same thing every quarter, right, where it doesn't make sense if somebody had actually been looking at it. Or sometimes they report that they're doing something that's actually not compliant with the program. Not on, you know, it's not an intentional fraud type of thing. The grantee thinks that it's part of the grant, it's covered, so they say that they're doing it, and then, but you can tell that nobody ever looked at it, because if they had, or if they had understood what they were supposed to do with that information, then there would have been follow-up and, hey, you, no, that's not an allowable expense. And so I do think there's, it gets back to this training component, right, of, okay, not just look at it, not just, you know, yep, they signed it, they dated it, okay, good, but what are we supposed to do with it? So I think it's a training issue more than anything.
Thank you. Representative Schultz, last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When I think about it and I think of what's transpired the last several years where we've seen such rampant fraud in our state and the hundreds of millions of dollars, it brings me back to the fact that this is, to your point, like these tools are already in the toolbox. And so I'm curious if you can provide any insight as to what agencies, even if you can give maybe the greatest example of success that you have seen for state agencies to kind of have a level of accountability within their agency, whether it's dealing with an individual employee, a department, that's working through these processes. I think that Minnesotans are really curious to know what accountability measures are in place and to what extent those things are happening within each agency.
Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Schultz. I'll go first, and then we'll see if Ms. Rodriguez wants to chime in. I think the programs and the agencies that are most successful in overseeing grants, and I'm not saying they're perfect, but that they're most successful, are the ones that take the oversight responsibility really seriously. And so it's not about punitive measures, right, of an employee of like, oh, wait, you didn't sign the progress report, you're in trouble. It's more just like in the air in those agencies of this is an important part of administering the programs. And I've talked about this, I think, with the Audit Commission about in state agencies having a oversight mentality in addition to supporting the grantees and in addition to supporting the programs and having this understanding that for the state to provide the best service, the intended service to the people who are supposed to be getting those services, that is, you know, hand in hand with ensuring the proper use of the funds, providing that regulatory oversight. And I think in some places we've gotten into maybe an imbalance where we're really focused on the program and the supporting the folks and helping. And there's a place for that, 100%, but it can't be all of it. Because at the end of the day, these state agency staff are responsible for ensuring the state money is used properly. And so there has to be a balance. And I think I think that's where that is present are the agencies and the offices and the programs where we find the fewest issues and where we see that, you know, the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed. And again, we're not expecting 100% perfection, right? It's people, we understand that. But again, I think it's the culture.
Thank you, Ms. Rodriguez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to add that I also think that there is something to be said for agencies, and I want to say that some agencies are too small to do this. But I want to say that those agencies that can have staff that have a really good knowledge of the financial aspects of grants management typically do well. And when those staff are in really good communication with the program staff, they tend to manage their grants well. So, you know, there's a lot of knowledge that is required to manage a grant effectively it's not always going to work to have one person doing all those pieces. But when you have people that are really experts in what they're doing, they're communicating really effectively, I think that that's spaces where we see that it tends to work well.
Thank you. So I know there's follow-up questions. I just want to throw one of my own follow-up questions in here. So we've gone through that we need more training. Got it. But there are requirements on the books to do the closeout evaluations, to stop payment if you're not getting progress reports. And it seems like enforcement is not happening. So if we've empowered OGM to do that and it's not happening, can you talk about, you know, in previous conversations, we've talked about embedding things in people's job descriptions, making it more clear who's responsible, and then holding people accountable. Can you talk about how we could better ensure enforcement? Because clearly the training's happening on and we may need more, but it's already a policy. So how can we enforce stop payment or do the progress reports or those things that have been highlighted here? Thank you. Representative Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So, yes, the legislature in 23 did empower admin, really, through the Office of Grants Management to enforce policy and procedure improvements. It is discretionary. So, you know, I think they have the authority to do it. They are not required to do it. They also, as we've discussed, you know, previously had three or four people, right? And they now have, I think they're getting close to 10 or 12. But for real, you know, enforcement, it requires doing the types of things OLA does, right? Going out, pulling a file review. You know, so if you want external enforcement like that, it's a lot of resources. And so, you know, that's one approach. And I'm looking in the report on pages 48 through 51, and I think maybe this has already been discussed, we walk through some options of how the legislature could increase external oversight of grants management. So that's the recommendation, and then we walk through how to do it. So one, you know, increase OGM's responsibility. So again, the 23 legislature did add it as a discretionary authority. So it's now in their wheelhouse if they want to use it. Another is looking at the role internal auditors play within an agency. So it's not as external, but it's at least an entity that's external to the grant or the grant program, and going in and having that be a priority to say, okay, I'm going to pull some random files and let's see if we're doing it. And that's a really great opportunity for continuous improvement for an agency. And then you could do an independent oversight unit, either within the executive branch or OLA. We're not asking for that, but you know, there's other options then that you could do. At the end of the day, though, enforcement, you know, is really going to come back to the legislature, right? Because all of these entities, you know, if it's OLA, if it's OGM, the best they're going to be able to do is report it back to you, and report it to the agency and say, hey, we're seeing issues here, here, and here, right? Let's clean that up. But in terms of, you know, enforcing compliance, I mean, one, that's something that the agencies have to, again, promote from within. And to be clear, we do believe that agencies want to manage these grants well. And so some of it is educating them on where they're failing, and then some of it is bringing it back to you all to decide how you want to use that information.
Thank you. Representative Greenman.
Thank you. And I guess this is sort of a question that I think is helpful here, but as we think about our work, as we think about both the agency staff and Office of Grants Management, are the same folks responsible for and sort of the oversight of both state funded grants and federally funded grants? Because I assume, or federally funded, mm-hmm. I assume that there's a whole set of sort of labyrinth of overlay that the federal government puts in. I know that as we think about some of the most recent issues of fraud that we are seeing sort of play their way through the courts, a lot of those have to do with federally provided resources. Is it the same infrastructure within our state agencies?
Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Greenman. It's a great question. Largely, yes. You know, a lot of grants are split, have some federal funding, have some state funding. But yeah, the management of grants is largely done by the program staff. And so a program often gets funding from state and federal and yeah.
Thank you. Just one more and then yeah. Representative Elkins after you.
Thank you. And I think for our work and as we think about it, right, we're thinking about both where the funding is coming from. So there's state and federal dollars that come sort of by grants, by sort of direct programs. Then there's the service providers, right? And we're talking about nonprofits today. There's also for-profits that we both grant and vend to. And then there's also government, both our state workers as well as local government. And then in some cases, and I was looking at this slide on your slide three, in some places it looks like even then we grant to sort of, we outsource the oversight, I'd say, like we sort of grant to an infrastructure then grants. And I think as we look at some of our past experiences, right, that we've seen and learned, I think we have to think about as the legislature, our job is not just to think about the sort of what happens on the agency side, but how are we both thinking about state and federal dollars, how are we thinking about our relationship to the providers, whether it should be government providers or nonprofits or vendors, and how that affects, again, the sort of fraud and conflict. So I think there's a really helpful thing. It's a relatively narrow as we think about sort of state funds to nonprofits. We do need to think about sort of the whole set of government funds and the whole set of providers, and I appreciate the question and the conversation.
Thank you. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I listened to the conversation this morning, the first thing that strikes me is that if it really feels like the next step here should be to hear from the Office of Grant Management. I'm hoping we can do that as quickly as possible so that we can learn about, you know, what's in progress, what's already been done, what's yet to be done. And then second, just kind of, you know, somewhere along the way, all of us will have a grant appropriation bill. And thinking back on my 8 years here, you know, probably about a half dozen of them, each of them has been different, quite a bit different. And I would probably, I would say, do things a lot differently on a lot of those if I knew then what I knew from reading all of the homework we had this weekend. And I think one of the outcomes of this is probably going to have to be some kind of at least high-level education for our colleagues about how all of this works and what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. So I'll just give one example. I've been carrying a bill for the Council on Disabilities for several sessions. Haven't got them any money for it yet, but just to provide money for them to administer a grant program to help cities and counties improve the digital accessibility of their websites. I've always, up until now, you know, resented the fact that the Department of Administration always wanted to collect like 15% vigorish off the top. That's the way I looked at it, to administer the grant program. And now I don't resent that anymore. And last session, the council came to me and said, you know, we think we can administer the grant ourselves and save that 15% or whatever it was. And now I look at that and say, can they really? Do they really have the capability in their small staff to do everything that needs to be done? Or do they at least need backup support from the Office of Grant Management? So I really enjoy, you know, I volunteered for this, and I've already just over the weekend for all the homework we had to do learned a tremendous amount. So I'm looking forward to the rest of our work here.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. And I concur that we need a culture change in the agencies. We need a culture change in the legislature about legislatively named grants. And we can all work on that with our colleagues together. Representative Rarick.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, I would recommend highly that we listen to the auditors and say, probably don't do it. We don't have the time to really do it properly. You know, like I worked over 20 years in nonprofits, and we really should, every time you're going to do direct appropriations to a nonprofit, you really should look at 3 years worth of 990s. You really should look at 3 years worth of audited financial statements. You really should look at the salaries. And as I started to do, the salaries of the executive people, because I've seen a multitude of 990s where the salaries of the top person is way higher than the governor. Mm-hmm. Way higher than the governor. In multitudes. So, and I would also say this too, since we're talking about this, there's a plethora of nonprofits that get in excess of 50% of, in charitable, I don't mean hospitals, I don't mean schools, charitable organizations that get over 50% of their revenue from government. If you think about, if you're going to do, if you're a local government and you're going to do a bonding project, that local government has to do a 50% match. Then we'll consider it as a bonding project. But you've got a whole bunch of nonprofits, and I don't have the number in front of me because I haven't dug that. Dug, maybe we should ask them to me. We can look at it. But there's a whole bunch of them that have executive staff that is way above what our governor is making and are getting more than 50% of their money from government. But my question, actually, before we wrap up, but just this conversation is excellent. I've never had it in my 13 years here at the legislature. This is unique, and I'm so excited to get to work on this across the aisle. Let's get this done, because I don't think that we have the time or expertise to be doing direct appropriations to nonprofits. But anyway, so my question, though, is so a little bit higher level, right? So I'm back to that page 7, which I love page 7 of your report. I could live in page 7. It's so informative. So one of the things that you calculated together, and I don't know how you arrived at this data. I guess that's really the question. But out of the 27 unique state agencies that are giving money to nonprofits or granting money to nonprofits, 25% of the recipients, 25% of the nonprofits were getting it from more than one state agency. Now, I know that you are the data experts, and I'm just amazed at what you're able to do. But short of you going in and looking at this, is there any way for agencies to say, oh, okay, so like the top of the list is Lutheran Social Services of Minnesota. So they have 10 different state agencies they're getting money from, right? So are these 10 agencies then coordinating and talking about this in collaboration? No. Is there any collaboration between state agencies whatsoever? Do they even know that other state agencies are also granting money to, the next one, a couple ones down is Clues. I only know of Clues because I've heard them so many times in different ones of my committees. Even further down on the list, you've got University of St. Thomas. So I'm going to invite University of St. Thomas into my committee and ask them those questions. But 7 state agencies give money to the University of St. Thomas. So is there anybody looking at this or even thinking about this?
Ms. Rodriguez.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Rarick. I think the short answer is no, not that we're aware of. First, as I said, the data to get to this, it's pretty complicated, 1. 2, you know, most state agencies are restricted in their access to this data. It's a need to know, and so they're not going to have data on, you know, other state agencies' work. A couple of things that already are in place. So state agencies are allowed to share closeout information. So after they have completed a grant, they are allowed to share closeout information with other state agencies about that grant. They're not required to, and in our survey, we found that they didn't. I know that there is a provision that came in 2023 about doing evaluations on grants. One thing I'll note about that, though, is that it's by grant, so it's not like a comprehensive look. So again, it's very difficult to get your hands around this information at a statewide level.
Thank you. And then Representative Anderson has a question. If you want to just finish up, Representative
Anderson. I will just finish up with a quick comment. So here's another place that we need to go, I think, members, is this, the high level look at things. And I would say, too, that I know that in previous conversations with the auditor, They don't go in and look at like the things I was talking about, like the they don't audit the nonprofit. They don't look at the 990, the audited financials, the salaries. They don't look at how much they're getting from government. That's our job to look at that, or the agency's job. But they don't. They just track the money to where the money was spent. But that's something that we could also do in addition to this high level. Maybe these agencies should talk to each other if they've got 10 agencies granting to the same entity. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Anderson. Vice Chair Anderson.
Yeah, thank you. I'll be real quick because I know we're over time and won't get into my opinions here, but I have a kind of a very specific question about the grant pathways. So when we have pathways where a grant is going from a state agency to pass through, then to another entity, is there any documentation required within, so there's policies and procedures that our state agency needs to follow or should be following, but does it go to that next level when you have, multiple layers here, which is what we have a lot?
Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Anderson. Yes, there should be, because there's usually a grant agreement or a contract or something between that pass-through grantee organization and the sub-grantee. So I'm thinking of when we did the performance audit on the Board on Aging, the Senior Nutrition Program. That's kind of an example of this. You all appropriated money to the Board on Aging. It went to the Area Agencies on Aging, which is like the pass-through grantee organization. It then went to the meal providers and then went down to the elderly person who received the meal. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there should be, and there was, agreements between the area agencies on aging and then the meal providers or the vendors. And then when we did that performance audit, for example, we went down and looked at all of those agreements and then pulled tests.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I consider everything that's been presented here today and the discussion that we've been having as members, it just really occurs to me that the core issue here is incentives. Where are the incentives to do the right thing? And in private transactions, the incentives are pretty natural, right? It's your money. You care about how it's spent, whether it's spent efficiently. Mm-hmm. The people who you engage with directly in a transaction are accountable to you on that transactional basis. Here, because we have all these layers of bureaucracy that come between where the money comes from, the taxpayer, and where it actually meets the ground with people receiving services, those incentives seem to be pretty clearly blurred in terms of ensuring that money's being spent efficiently. When I asked my son to clean his room, he can tell me it did. That's a report. It's a progress report. But I have to validate by putting my eyes on whether or not it actually happened. And it's been pointed out in the report on multiple different occasions. I'll just cite this one area regarding MDE. When it comes to site visits, when it comes to verifications, if I can be granted the grace to just quote directly, according to OGM policy, 15 of the 16 MDE grants over our review required at least one monitoring visit during the grant lifetime, and 13 required annual monitoring visits. OGM policy states that although visits may be made in person or by telephone, that they recommend that occur in person whenever possible. The policy also states that the monitoring visit should include a review of progress against the grant's goals and discussion of any problems. MDE did not provide evidence it conducted monitoring visits for 14 of the 15 grants that required monitoring visits. Obviously, that's an issue. The other thing that I see pointed out is the potential of these monitoring visits being conducted by telephone. My question would be, how effective is that in terms of if you're going to call somebody up and just kind of ask them, hey, are you doing what you're supposed to do? Are you going to be able to catch something like was reported by Jay Coles in recent weeks of an alleged daycare center that's very clearly not actually operating as such?
Ms. Rodriguez or Ms. Randall?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Hudson. I will say that OLA is in favor of on-site visits and thinks that that's the best way to be able to see that the grant program is being implemented in the way it's intended. I will acknowledge, of course, that it's more resource intensive, right, to go do an on-site visit than to, you know, you could call all your grantees in one afternoon maybe, but you can't necessarily travel to all of them. And so that is why in the grants management policies there are kind of thresholds at which, you know, you have to do a monitoring visit annually or just once and all of that. But I do think there is a role to encourage / require on-site visits when grants reach a certain threshold. And I think the question is what are those thresholds?
Thank you. Representative Hudson?
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I don't see any more questions, and I greatly appreciate everyone's – oh, I'm sorry. Representative Lead Pinto, forgive me. I didn't see that.
No problem, Madam Chair. And this is sort of a broader point, though I suppose it does connect to the OLA's work. Of course, perhaps the most notable scheme of fraud that a lot of us have been noting the last couple of years is Feeding Our Future. As the chair, I think, and members are aware, there's a major criminal trial happening right now in that case. I became aware over the weekend, I sent you, Madam Chair, a note, and also to Chair Bennett, that the Education Policy Committee is having a hearing tomorrow, I think, that OLA is presenting. And I really, as a prosecutor, that kind of freaks me out, just to use a technical phrase. I don't know if the U.S. Attorney's Office has said we have no concerns with the conflict, and if so, then obviously no problem. They're the ones prosecuting the case. If U.S. Attorney's Office has not signed off on that, then I guess I would urge Madam Chair, I just want to bring up now that the Chair Bennett would postpone that. There'll be plenty of other time, but I would hate to have a conviction somehow get overturned on appeal. I think the last thing we'd want to do is have anything that we would do at the legislature interfere with a criminal charge relating to alleged fraudsters. And so I really would want to urge that it either be postponed or at the very least check in with the U.S. Attorney's Office. And so Madam Chair would urge that.
Thank you, Chair. Lead Pinto, I did see your note over the weekend, and my advice is that the U.S. Attorney fully knows how to contact Chair Bennett, and if they want to reach out, that's up to them, or Chair Bennett, but that's not the jurisdiction of this committee. So, Lead Pinto.
Thank you so much. I would think presumably their prosecutors are pretty busy prosecuting multiple folks, and I just want to say it's a bit of a roll of the dice, and I would hate to have our legislature or the folks controlling the committees at this point have there be any chance of interference. I understand that obviously telephones exist, they could do that, but I would really urge we not roll the dice on this, not have any kind of gamble.
Thank you. I encourage you, Lead Pinto, to contact Chair Bennett directly. That is not the purview of this committee. So with that, I appreciate the great conversation today, and I greatly appreciate the testimony and the hard work of Office of Legislative Auditor Randall and Deputy Auditor Rodriguez. Your work is exemplary, and we all greatly appreciate it. And I would just like to point out to my colleagues that these are things that have been going on since 2019. And it was referenced that this is a 2023 report that the OLA did. But I would just like to draw to everyone's attention, which was in your packet, their update of their 2023 report since the changes were made for the Office of Grants Management that came out this month, February 2024. And it is filled with detail that all of us should be considering on things the Office of Grants Management has implemented, things they haven't, and why that might be. So this is a very timely topic. It's not old news, and I'm grateful that you came and presented to us today. And with that, members, our next meeting will be on Monday, the 17th of February, here at 8:15. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.